Hello, I'm George Mather. This is number 0881, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. And it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0881. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet Ryan Ray Vincent, who is an actor who is quite successful in the hot new craze of microdramas. Are microdramas the next big thing in Hollywood?
If you look back throughout the generations, the past 100 years, it's always shifting in what seems like a dramatic way. And usually the people that are in Hollywood at one moment, as it begins to shift, are resistant and they don't understand. And it seems like this is history repeating itself. I don't know for sure that this is a thing and how long it's going to last, but this is plausibly the next shift in history of this town, of this business of entertainment.
Mark Farrington is the author of the novel Loss of Life. It deals with a man whom, after a car accident, has partial retrograde amnesia, removing his recent memory, only remembering his childhood.
He goes to a grocery store and he starts picking out food that he recognizes and remembers liking. And he gets to the checkout and he empties the basket and it's full of things like hot dogs and ice cream, because those are the things he remembers liking when he was 13. And that's the last memory he has of ever of groceries. But the amnesia itself was really a vehicle for me to bring this character to the point where he was going to do an honest and thorough investigation of his past life.
Mark Hartzman, curator of WeirdHistorian.com, has a special segment. It's not a story from the past, but instead, it's a trip that he took. Mark literally ran off with the circus.
I did. Yeah, it was great fun. Ran off to the circus in Baraboo, Wisconsin. Baraboo is, of course, famous for being the birthplace of the Ringling Brothers Circus, so there's a real rich circus history there. I went for the Circus Historical Society's convention. Dan Meyer and I spoke about our book, To the Hilt, so we gave a presentation on the history of sword swallowing, also a little bit of our own background. All of this culminated in Dan giving a live demonstration of sword swallowing, which is always fun, even at a Circus Historical Society convention.
And there's lots and lots of Stuff File news, Dad Joke Theater, Sir Dudley's Poetry Corner, a morning shower thought, and of course, an idiot of the day. The guest Slater, the person who told you this was show number 0881, was George Mather, a retired broadcaster, lawyer, and an early colleague of mine in my first on-air job in Brockville, Ontario. Thank you very much, George, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a show that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, let's get right to the stuff. A masked vigilante dubbed the Batman of Lagos de Moreno is being sought by Mexican police after allegedly capturing suspected thieves and taping them to lampposts. At least 5 men were found bound with silver duct tape across the Jalisco region over 10 days, beginning June 13th. Many had ratero, Spanish for thief, written on their faces, along with drawn-on mustaches and cat whiskers. Some showed signs of beating. The stolen bikes, allegedly belonging to victims, were left nearby. 5 such incidents have been confirmed. Investigators are examining the cases, noting that the bound men are currently considered victims of unlawful assault. No arrests have been made. I wonder if he fights crime in a rubber suit. Also, can he say the signature Batman line?
What the hell are you? I'm Batman.
I'm assuming he'd say it in Spanish.
¿Qué coño eres?
Soy Batman.
A New Jersey middle school is replacing all yearbooks after a baby photo of Adolf Hitler was found hidden inside. The image appeared among childhood snapshots of recent graduates at Eastbrook Middle School in Paramus. A teacher spotted the black and white photo, taken shortly after Hitler's 1889th birth, embedded within a larger collage. School officials believe a student deliberately placed it there. The principal sent a letter to families calling the image unacceptable, stating it has no place in a student yearbook and does not reflect who we are or what Eastbrook stands for. All yearbooks were collected before students could take them home. Local police are investigating. Well, kudos to that really eagle-eyed teacher who spotted the baby picture amongst a collage of baby pictures. Because I'm assuming that Hitler's 1889 baby picture didn't have that signature mustache. Lillian Droniak, the 96-year-old social media personality known as Grandma Droniak, and let's stop right there. I'm guessing nobody had on their bingo card the phrase, the 96-year-old social media personality. Anyway, Grandma Droniak says her retirement home threatened to evict her over late-night parties. In a viral TikTok posted on June 11th, she displayed a formal warning letter citing noise complaints, alcohol being served to residents, and guests leaving her room at 1 a.m. Grandma Droniak said, I could do what I want. I pay $12,000 a month to live here. I can't help it. I love to party. You can't stop me. A representative has now said the situation has since been resolved. The home will allow late visitors, but prohibits Droniak from supplying alcohol. Droniak, who has millions of followers, has lived in the undisclosed retirement home since June of 2024. You go, girl! She's paying $12,000 a month. Why is it that some seniors' homes act like their only reason for existence is because they're God's waiting room, or they're treating the residents like they're forgotten items in the back of the refrigerator? Party on, Grandma Droniak. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, a Domino's manager from Manassas, Virginia, has been named the world's fastest pizza maker after assembling three large pizzas in just 31.22 seconds. Richard Delsed claimed the title at the Domino's World Fastest Pizza Making Competition in Las Vegas on May 13th, winning $5,000, a trophy, and a championship belt. Competitors were required to hand-stretch dough, spread sauce, and distribute toppings on one pepperoni, one mushroom, and one cheese pizza, all inspected for quality. Said Delsed, this competition isn't just about speed, it's about delivering quality under pressure. He credits his start at Domino's to his sister, who hired him in high school, saying, honestly, she didn't see me as a manager. And now the manager has his own 13-year-old daughter, and she's proud of her dad.
She actually texted me saying, hey, my friends are asking about you. Are you, you know, the world's fastest pizza maker? And I'm telling them, yeah. It means a lot. I can't explain it, honestly.
I guess that's why they talk about speed in their commercials.
Only Domino's Pizza delivers in 30 minutes or less. None of the rest are always this hot, this fresh.
And let's get to our first guest here in this edition of the Stuff All program, shall we? Actor Ryan Ray Vincent is one of the leading faces of Hollywood's booming microdrama movement, starring in 30-plus series, reaching tens of millions of viewers each month. Ryan joins us from Los Angeles via Riverside.com. Hi, Ryan.
How are you? What a beautiful introduction. Thank you so much for having me today.
Thank you for being on the program. It's a pleasure to have you on. I go back to an era, when Quibi first came along. And yeah. Quibi is dead and gone. What was wrong with Quibi, and was it just ahead of its time?
I think that's what the big debate is. As I recall, Jeffrey Katzenberg, that was the face of that whole moment. You know, he had all the right pieces in play, but I just don't think that the world, and I mean the viewers of television and program storytelling, were ready or willing to accept, or the conditioning hadn't occurred yet of how everybody stares at their cell phone for so long. I mean, what I read in 2025, the average screen time for anyone was around, with the smartphone that is around 10 hours a day. And that's accumulated from social media and looking at your bank statement and texting and whatever. So it's just an enormous amount of time. But I just don't know if the shift had taken place where we're relying on the cell phone or short form content yet as much as we are in the past, I'd say 3 years, which ultimately made Quibi just a bit too early. So again, I'm speculating, but that's my two cents on the situation there.
Okay, so flash forward from Quibi to today, where China is starting a $7 billion industry annually, and it's outpacing their domestic film making there in China. So you have been an actor for a while. When you first started doing micro dramas, what was your initial response as to where this was going based on everything you had done up until that point?
Well, I kind of looked at it in a metaphorical way, as if it was like the new kid at school. He's sitting by himself in the cafeteria because nobody understands him yet. No one is taking the time. They're too scared. They're too insecure, really, to just say, well, what's this about? Let me go introduce myself. But I looked at it that way, and importantly, because I was like, you know what? I think there's something over there. I think there's something different. And now things have started to shift. I think at that time it was the new kid at school, and it was misunderstood, and so it was easy to judge. And I think that's what the majority of the actors that I was around or associated with through film or television or just in classes around town, everybody was looking at it like, well, that's stupid, that's silly, it's immature, it's a fad, it's beneath everything that I've ever thought of myself of as an actor. And in a way, I was understanding to that, because it was very, I don't know, it was just kind of silly almost, instead of being taken serious. So, but I got myself out of my own way and ultimately got on board because I saw the bigger picture. I thought, it's just a matter of time that everyone gets to know the new kid at school, and they realize that the new kid at school has something interesting, has something different. And instead of judging it, let's go with it and see where this ends up, you know? I think that's the other thing too, is that, you know, this is a very difficult industry historically, generations. One of my favorite interviews is with Orson Welles, and he talks about how everyone he loves came to Hollywood and then has just been like tarnished and stained and a lesser person. Their light has been dimmed by this town. And, you know, that's very sad, but it's also very true, because it really doesn't appreciate hard work as much as it just chooses and it picks. And so this kind of created an avenue for people that weren't necessarily chosen, but who had some kind of talent or something to offer, to have a platform. And so I think that was a beautiful thing as an actor. And I think that was a part of the growth of it as well, because you have a lot of people that are wanting to be a part of this business and don't have a way in, and now they get to do that. I'm a big fan of MMA, and there's something that you'll notice, that you'll watch a fighter who's on their way up. They're winning, they're winning, they're winning. And when they've gotten to the point where they've won their championship, everything changes. Now the reason they're fighting is to maintain instead of climbing. And it's a total different fighter. Statistically, they ultimately lose, whether it's the next fight or one to come, and then they never really rise again. And I think there's something interesting about taking actors that haven't really made it. They're not Kevin Costner. They're not some name that we're all familiar with. And we're growing because they're hungry. The industry's hungry. It's all kind of working together. So That's something I think I identified pretty quickly. And I thought, you know, I'm going to stop judging this like everybody I know is, and I'm going to take it serious and I'm going to try to see where it leads.
Well, you said it was just a matter of time, but even though you had that optimistic outlook of what microdramas was going to be, did you anticipate that it was going to have this meteoric rise that it actually has?
I don't think I could anticipate that it would. I was definitely taking a chance by committing myself and my time to it that it could end at any given second. It could be, you know, Beanie Babies. It could be just NFTs. It could be the hot thing for the next the rest of the summer and that's it. But there was another part of me that thought, well, Hollywood, if you look back throughout the generations, the past 100 years, you know, it's always shifting in what seems like a dramatic way. Usually the people that are in Hollywood at one moment as it begins to shift are resistant and they don't understand. And it seems like, okay, this is kind of history repeating itself. I don't know for sure that this is a thing and how long it's going to last, but I think this is plausibly the next shift in history of this town, of this business, of entertainment. And I'd rather take the risk in being a part of it. So as much as I didn't know where it was going to go, I was willing to just throw my stock in and just see where it goes.
You've mentioned that you've done television and films. How different is it to do a microdrama? I mean, first of all, it's a vertical vision. So are all of the actors closer together? Is the set smaller? What's that like?
Oh, you're absolutely right. It's much more narrow of a frame to be in. So you have to be kind of on top of each other. But as far as the difference, that's the very obvious is the pacing. I was on the set of Blonde with Ana de Armas. It was directed by Andrew Dominik in 2019. And I remember being there all day and we were shooting two scenes the whole day. And I mean, you know, I believe it went into overtime probably 13, 14 hours. And so it was just impressive, but it was also at that moment, I was like, okay, this is how you make a real big budget dramatic film. And now fast forward and I'm doing these and I'm on set. I mean, we're doing 20 pages a day. It is, get, you know, your lines, find your angle and then shoot. And a lot of times, as soon as they get your coverage, it's just flip it and move on. And so, which you have to anticipate. So you want to get your weak stuff out in the car ride on the way to set, because a lot of times you'll get the script the night before. So you don't have much time to prep. There's a great book that I refer to often called True and False by David Mamet. And he references a director talking about actors. He's like, look, I've already written the lines. I'm going to tell you where to stand. I'm giving you the clothes. I'm putting a spotlight on you. Just say the line with some kind of spontaneity. Just be right there, be present. And that's all I need. And sometimes I just allow myself to look at it that simple in order to keep this thing going. Because I also acknowledge that I'm not the only one on set. There's all these other actors. There's all these other crew, which is usually working for less money and more hours. And everybody has their own personal lives. So it's like this machine has to work with a pace that is just, you can't slow down for the traditional kind of approach towards storytelling.
In the grand scheme of things, a particular microdrama, how long would it last running time? How many episodes would that be running time? And how long would it take for you to create one as an actor?
Well, I think that the easiest way to look at it is say, we're making a movie, a very traditional 90 minute or so feature length film. But the writing style is written with these cliffhangers that happen every 60 to 90 seconds, which ultimately will be your episodes. So inside 90 minutes, you get, let's say, 55 to 70 or so episodes that can be chopped up so you can watch them in these kind of bite-sized cliffhanger moments. You know, and I think it's designed specifically as if you were at a cocktail party and someone's passing hors d'oeuvres. You can continue to socialize and enjoy the evening as someone walks by with a little quiche and you just take a bite and it was delicious and then you carry on. It's kind of the same concept, just watching entertainment. I think that's That's the best way to use a metaphor for that.
And when it comes to films, there's the Oscars. When it comes to television, there's the Emmys. What is available for microdramas, if not now, maybe in the future?
Well, that's a very interesting question, because right now, since it's still 90% is the more recent statistic I saw of the audience that watches this is in China. So that means you have a fraction of people really in this country that's watching. So all the awards or any kind of acknowledgments that are going on is purely fan driven, which ultimately is the same audience that's been watching General Hospital and Days of Our Lives for all these years. They've just switched over to their cell phones. So I've been a part of a couple awards ceremonies, but again, they are 100% ran by the fans, voted on by the fans, and attended by the fans. Now, in the future, I think that could plausibly change just as more mainstream people are getting involved, whether it's a production, a studio, or ultimately a network. And then I think the industry will have to respond with some kind of process like that.
Well, Ryan, thank you very much for being on the program with us. May you be the first person with a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame for microdramas.
Oh, wouldn't that be a crazy? You know, the one thing I have learned about living in Los Angeles and pursuing this path is that it is so non-linear. There is no A, B, C, D. I used to work construction where I was raised in Cleveland, Ohio, and I just knew, like, you have to start laying bricks. You have to get your hands dirty first. You cannot be the foreman without years of experience and understanding and somebody else validating that you earned your spot. But this is just such a crazy, bizarre path. So, you know, I hope you're absolutely right. And I'm going to stick around for a long time to find out. So we shall see.
Ryan, thank you very much for being on the program.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Actor Ryan Ray Vincent, star of many a microdrama. To find out which titles he's in and also where you can find them, the best place is to head to his Instagram page. You can go to our website at thestufffile.com to the page for this show, which is show number 0881, and you'll find links to Ryan's Instagram site. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
And now, Dad Joke Theater.
I had a really happy childhood. My dad used to put me in tires and roll me down hills. Those were good years.
Join us again for another Stuff File program, Dad Joke Theater.
There's still more guests, more news, and an idiot of the day coming your way on the Stuff File program. Stay tuned. The Stuff File program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program. Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like, but the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram.
Does it feel to you like AI is taking over? That the bots are winning? That AI actually stands for alarmingly invasive? If you crave more human connection, reach out to friends, play with your children, call your mom, and do what you're doing right now. Listen to the radio. Radio is thankfully, imperfectly, human. No ifs, ands, or buts.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, coming to you from Montreal, Canada, where we share the longest unprotected border in the world with the United States. Take that as a sign of extreme friendship or a warning.
And still to come in the program, we'll talk to Mark Farrington, author of Loss of Life. We have a special segment with Mark Hartzman, the curator of WeirdHistorian.com, where he actually ran off to the circus. And, of course, we do have Sir Dudley's Poetry Corner, a morning shower thought, and an idiot of the day coming your way. But right now, we've got much more in Stuff File News right here, right now. Washington, D.C. has agreed to pay an undisclosed settlement to a man detained for playing the Imperial March from Star Wars while following National Guard troops through the city. Sam O'Hara was handcuffed for 15 to 20 minutes on September 11th of last year. The ACLU, D.C. says Ohio National Guard Sergeant Devin Beck asked D.C. police to handle O'Hara during the protest. The lawsuit against Beck remains ongoing. O'Hara began the protest after President Trump deployed National Guard troops to patrol D.C. in August of 2025. Said O'Hara, "The government's efforts to silence me ultimately backfired." ACLU D.C. legal director Scott Michaelman called the episode a reminder that officials can't punish someone for their speech. Well, I must admit that there are now a myriad of protesters who really, really, really have a sense of humor. A 19-year-old man from the UK has admitted deliberately defecating in a community swimming pool 18 times over several months. The incidents at Newcastle Emlyn Swimming Pool occurred between February 2nd and May 21st of this year, forcing repeated closures for cleaning and safety procedures. Staff reviewed hours of CCTV footage to identify the suspect, who fully admitted the offenses after being interviewed by police. The charity-run pool reported significant financial losses from refunds, lost bookings, and reduced attendance, said a pool spokesman. "Our funds have been depleted by these incidents, and any donations or offers of financial help would be greatly appreciated." No further incidents have occurred since the individual was identified. Gosh. His parents must be so proud. Police in Chandler, Arizona, were in the middle of a SWAT operation when a vehicle turned into the scene. Officers ordered the vehicle to turn around, but Dot, the DoorDash food delivery robot, doesn't seem to understand verbal commands, so it kept on going. Police apparently put barricades around the bot, trapping it in place, until DoorDash support arrived in a truck and used a remote control to take it to the truck to haul it away. You know, this is a sign of the times. It's all about the robot. Did you hear anything about the hungry customer left waiting? No, it's all about the robot.
When great hunger meets great innovation, there is only one robot for the job. Introducing Dot, your local delivery robot.
And we have one more Stuff File news story before we get to our next guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. And it's time for the Mayor Larry Vaughn Bad Judgment in Leadership Award.
Now, if you fellas are concerned about the beaches, you do whatever you have to make them safe. But those beaches will be open for this weekend.
Two statues in Ellicott City, Maryland, one depicting a peach and the other an eggplant, faced opposition from the city's Historic Preservation Commission. The commission members were concerned the sculptures detracted from the area's historic buildings and asked the businesses displaying them, Georgia Grace Cafe and the Wine Bin, to remove them. Paula Dwyer, owner of the cafe, said it was because of the innuendos with the peach and the eggplant. The community was mostly supportive of the statues, and some didn't get the fuss. Said David Carney, owner of the wine shop, "I guess I don't quite understand the innuendo because I have one of those body parts and it doesn't look like that and it's not purple." When the businesses refused removal, the commission took them to court, but a judge ruled that both installations can stay, as art installations are not under the commission's purview. Said Dwyer, this was just a huge thing, and it just shows what people can do when they come together. Which, when you think about it, is what the emojis are all about in the first place. I guess the commission had an emotional reaction. And that's your Mayor Larry Vaughn Bad Judgment in Leadership Award.
Let's be reasonable, huh? This is not the time or the place to perform some kind of a half-assed autopsy on a fish.
And now, this.
The Stuff File presents Sir Dudley Piddley Havisham Sedgwick Smythe's Poetry Corner.
There once was a girl named Cheryl, who raised a small kitten quite feral. It scratched at the door, then hissed at the floor, and put her fine rugs in great peril.
And let's get to our next guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Mark Farrington is a recently retired writing teacher of nearly 40 years, the last 25 of them teaching at Johns Hopkins University. He has written many short stories in the past, but he's now written his first novel. It's called Loss of Life. Mark joins us from Portland, Maine via Riverside.com. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Peter. How are you?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks very much for taking the time to be on the program with us. As I mentioned, you were a teaching professor for nearly 40 years, and you've written short stories, but now you've decided to write your first novel. Why wait so long?
Well, I had written or tried to write a couple of novels over the years. They didn't quite work out, but this was one that I'd been thinking about for a long time. And when I finally got the chance to really focus on it, it went very well. And I was very pleased with the work I was doing. So everything just kind of came together for me with this book.
Before you get into the topic of the book, and it does involve an actual teaching professor, which is something that you have done for so many years, I'm just wondering, when it comes to teaching, obviously, your students are inspired by what you have to bring to them as a teacher. But what inspires, if anything, from them of you as a writer?
That's a good question. I've always felt that being both a writer and a teacher, each one helps the other. As a teacher, I have to learn how to explain the kinds of things that I want students to be able to learn and to think about. In explaining them and figuring out how to make that clear, they become clearer to me as well as a writer. And so I can apply some of those things that I've gotten a better understanding about because I've had to teach them. I've also, in seeing all writers make mistakes often, and I tell students sometimes, you know, the main difference between you and me is that I've made more mistakes than you have already, but you learn from those mistakes. And so seeing things that my students are grappling with at the level that they happen to be at the moment helps me again to look at any of the areas that I might be struggling in as well and to say, okay, I can help that student figure out how to get over that obstacle because I've done it myself in my own writing, or sometimes in trying to help the student get over an obstacle I have not encountered before in my writing, I will learn something that then I can apply to my writing later. So they work hand in hand, or they have for me anyway, for a long time. It's been gratifying to me to be able to do both, because I love to do both.
What is the novel Loss of Life all about?
Well, the main character is 41-year-old Matthew Winton, who wakes up at the beginning of the novel in a hospital and is told that he's had a car accident. He doesn't remember the accident, and as time goes on, he realizes that he has lost his memory of the last 25 or so years of his life. He can remember back to when he was a child, and he can remember things from his childhood up through about the age of 13 or 14. But after that, he has no memory whatsoever. He lives alone, he has no family, and he's, in a way, he is a teacher. He's a college professor who teaches writing. That's something that I knew, so I could fill in the details of his life in that regard because I've done it myself. But he's essentially living a reclusive life, and so he really has to figure out for himself how to navigate this world that is totally new to him. He doesn't know how to turn on a computer, for instance. He doesn't recognize anyone that he met after the age of 13. So he doesn't know who he is friends with. He doesn't know if he's hurt somebody. He doesn't know who he's loved. He has to basically start from scratch. In his home, he finds hundreds of books, and he can't remember even one of them or having read any one of them. He doesn't know how to teach. He can't remember how to teach. So it's really a matter of him trying to navigate his life, because his life is, for him, is brand new.
I guess for all writers, there is a what if going on in their head when it comes to jotting down or typing a particular story. So what was the inspiration for Loss of Life?
I've long been fascinated with memory and the importance of memory, and particularly for someone like myself. I was 44 years old when I married for the first time. My wife and I have no children, and particularly along, I think, with, you know, with the fact that I do write, and so I'm very conscious of getting into the past of characters and just the value of the past. I've always felt that, for me anyway, my memories were the greatest proof that I've been alive. I'm not very big on material things, and so I go into my head, and it's those things that I remember having done, or places I've been, people I've known. Those are the things that, to me, are my life. I wanted to put some pressure on this character because I wanted him to examine his own life in a direct and more honest way than he ever had before. And so the best way to do that, I thought, was taking that life away. He goes into all this because he does want to recapture his past. He does want to regain his memories, but at the same time, he's not sure. He's a little bit wary of it all because he doesn't know what those memories are going to be. He doesn't know what he has done. He doesn't know what might have been done to him. And in fact, there's a policewoman who investigates the accident who comes to see him in the hospital early on, and they develop a friendship, and she helps him a bit. And there's a point where she offers to go to his home and to pick up some things for him while he's still in the hospital, some clothes and that kind of thing. So that he can go home. And he says to her, half jokingly, "I can't promise that when you walk in the front door, you won't find a dead body." And it's because he has no idea, absolutely no idea about what he might have done or anything really related to the last 27 years of his life. So that was the what if. The amnesia itself, I had fun with the amnesia because there are instances where, for instance, he goes to a grocery store and he starts picking out food that he recognizes and remembers liking. And he gets to the checkout and he empties the basket and it's full of things like hot dogs and ice cream because those are the things he remembers liking when he was 13. And that's the last memory he has of groceries. So I had some fun with that particular part of it. But the amnesia itself was really a vehicle for me to bring this character to the point where he was going to do an honest and thorough investigation of his past life, which he wasn't doing on his own. He was coming up with all kinds of ways to deflect or to spin the things that he had done or things that had happened to him. The sort of what if is, you know, what if he had to look at his past in a clearer and more objective way? The amnesia sort of forced him to do that.
You've written a first-time novel, again, as a teacher. Does it make it any easier to write a novel after writing short stories? In other words, is it a different muscle or muscle memory to write a full-fledged novel? And did you, as a teacher, avoid some of those pitfalls that some writers might have going from short story to novel?
I don't know that it's a different muscle. It's a muscle that you use. You have to use more and for a longer period of time because you're now dealing with 300 pages instead of, you know, 15 or 20. And so keeping track of everything and having the sense of how it's moving and where pieces might fit best, those are all things that you do when writing a story, but not anywhere near to the degree that you do with a novel. One of the ways that I write, and there are many different ways to write, so I don't force my process on anyone else, but one of the ways that I write is to take something that I know when I'm starting out and go with it and let it sort of tell me where it wants to go. And I think of writing as a compromise between the ideas that I want to explore and also the things that the writing itself tells me I should be exploring. And so that's easier to do with a short story, because if you're on page 7 of a 300-page novel and you have no idea what's going to happen after you get to page 50, it can be a little bit daunting. So getting used to that, I think, is one of the things that that's hard to do, and is much harder to do than it is with stories. A writing professor that I once had said that with the first novel, until you get to page 250, you won't really believe that it's going to be a novel. So it requires, the novel requires a lot more faith, I think, than writing a story.
Well, I guess the analogy I would make is also the difference between a sprinter and a marathon runner. But just based on what you said, are you more of a pantser than a plotter?
Yeah. I think I do a little bit of both, but I know that for me, there are things in my writing that I'm not consciously aware of, and there are things that come up out of the writing that I never imagined and certainly never planned. And over my experience has been that those are often some of the best things in the writing that I'm doing, those things that come up that surprise me when they come up. And so that's the thing that I look for. And in fact, when I'm starting out on a book or a story on any given day, if I write for a while and nothing surprises me about what I write, I generally tend to think it didn't go very well, because I'm always looking for those things that pop up unexpectedly.
Now that you've written your first novel, Loss of Life, is there a second one, maybe even a third one?
I hope. Right now, I'm putting together a collection of my short stories. I've also started kind of wading into the possibility of another novel. Starting out, I'm just exploring ideas that come to me, or images, things that I've been thinking about, and I'll sit down and I'll write a page or two and see if there's something there that I like. And then after a while, if it does seem to be going somewhere and I'm interested in what I'm doing, I'll start thinking about trying to put it together and what kind of a shape it might take and all of that. I think having written this novel, I am more inclined to think of anything new that I'm starting as another potential novel. Whereas in the past, when I would start writing something, usually I would first think, oh, well, that's going to be a short story. So I'm more comfortable, I think, thinking of myself as a novelist now.
Well, congratulations on your first novel, Loss of Life. And thank you very, very much, Mark, for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Thank you. I enjoyed it a great deal.
Mark Farrington, author of Loss of Life. You can go to our website at thestufffile.com to the page for this show, which is show number 0881, and you'll find links to Mark's website, plus links to either amazon.com or amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
Giving you something to think about, this is Morning Shower Thoughts.
If you buy a bigger bed, aren't you left with more bedroom? But less bedroom?
Morning Shower Thoughts from the Stuff File program.
Got something for the mailbag? Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. Send your email to mailbag@thestufffile.com. And remember, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H. That's mailbag@thestufffile.com. Or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
The Stuff File program is everywhere on several stations and on several platforms, including YouTube.
The YouTube handle is youtube.com/@PeterAnthonyHolder-StuffFile.
That's kind of long-winded, isn't it? Just go to YouTube and type out my name, Peter Anthony Holder.
On YouTube, you'll find interviews, short vertical videos, and more. There's lots to check out.
Again, that's youtube.com/@PeterAnthonyHolder-StuffFile.
Oh, for the love of God, just go to YouTube and type in my name.
You're listening to The Stuff File program. Good times start here. Where they end up depends on how good your legal team is. Here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, a special extra segment with Mark Hartzman, the curator of WeirdHistorian.com. We do have an idiot of the day coming your way, but I've got one more Stuff File news story to share with you right here, right now. A Florida woman is facing felony charges after a bag of cocaine fell from her buttocks during jail intake. 30-year-old Reagan Cox was pulled over on a Brevard County highway at around 6:40 a.m. on June 26 after her car was seen veering across lanes. Officers detected a marijuana smell and described Cox as slow and lethargic. She resisted deputies before being transported to a county jail. An X-ray scanner flagged an anomaly in her lower region. When jailers moved her hand away from her buttocks, a baggie containing 3.8 grams of cocaine fell out. Cox denied ownership, claiming an unnamed partner placed it there during an intimate encounter. She was charged with introducing contraband into a correctional facility and released on $3,000 bond. Really? Putting a baggie of drugs in someone's backside is now considered foreplay? Yeah. And let's get to our last guest here in this edition of the Stuff All program, shall we? Mark Hartzman is the curator of WeirdHistorian.com and also the publisher at CuriousPublications.com. He's the author of several books. His most recent one, co-authored with Dan Meyer, is called To the Hilt, A Sword Swallower's History of Sword Swallowing. Of course, listeners know his monthly visits for weird historical stories of the past, but this time around, we're talking about a visit of his own when he went to the Circus Historical Society convention. Mark joins us from New York via Riverside.com. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Peter. Thanks for having me again.
Thanks for being on the program once again. So you literally ran off to the circus.
I did. Yeah, it was great fun. Ran off to the circus in Baraboo, Wisconsin. Baraboo is, of course, famous for being the birthplace of the Ringling Brothers Circus in the late 1800s. So there's a real rich circus history there. Yeah, I went for the Circus Historical Society's convention. Dan Meyer and I spoke about our book, To the Hilt, which you mentioned. So we gave a presentation on the history of sword swallowing. Also a little bit of our own background, how I got into writing about sideshows and the different kinds of stories I've written about sword swallowers. And Dan, of course, described how he got into becoming a sword swallower and why. And then we went into some of the histories of different sword swallowers from the past. All of this culminated in Dan giving a live demonstration of sword swallowing, which is always fun. Even at a Circus Historical Society convention, there were still people who were, of course, shocked and amazed seeing this. A lot of them hadn't seen a sword swallower live, I don't think. So I love just seeing all their expressions, their, you know, jaws dropping and gasps. And it's a lot of fun. Dan puts on a great show. So we had a great time doing that and then, you know, selling some books and meeting all kinds of amazing people with really fascinating circus backgrounds. So it was really an incredible time. And I found myself one evening in the front row of the International Clown Hall of Fame induction ceremony, which was a lot of fun. As you can imagine, it was quite funny, as you would expect a clown inducting another clown into the Hall of Fame, complete with gags. And they weren't dressed like clowns. These were the retired, you know, they've been doing this for decades. They were all dressed in suits. You'd never know they were clowns if you just looked at them. But then once they start kind of getting into their characters presenting, it was very funny. And you could see the clown coming out from each of them. So it was really an enjoyable evening.
Well, even though they weren't wearing their clown costume, wasn't there a hint, like, for instance, they all stepped out of the same car?
You know, that would have been a great entrance, actually. They didn't do that. But they did put on a pretty, you know, it was an entertaining induction and an emotional one. They had inducted first a man named Jerry Bangs, who was a guy, a very innovative designer of props and gags for clowns, for Ringling, from like the 30s through the late 40s, and then other shows afterward. And then after that, they inducted the executive director of the Clown Hall of Fame, who didn't know he was being inducted. The whole board went behind his back to induct him. So it was pretty emotional. He was very surprised by the whole thing. And, you know, you could see that this man who had given so much joy to so many people for so long was feeling that joy coming back to him with this honor. So it was really quite a special event, and it was really a thrill to be there. And then the Clown Hall of Fame itself is just a few blocks away from the convention space. So we got to go over there, and I was so happy in the International Clown Hall of Fame, just walking around the different exhibits and seeing all these clown props and costumes, clown shoe displays. You know, they had Emma Kelly, Bozo, Lou Jacobs, all these other famous clowns. So that was just, you know, so much happiness just being in a clown museum surrounded by clowns. I felt so good there. And then there was also the Circus Royal Museum is also just down the street. And so we got to go there. They have an amazing exhibit, a huge collection of circus memorabilia and props and posters and artwork, which was beautiful. And then outside they have a whole space with it's just devoted to the circus wagons, you know, from the late 1800s and early 1900s. And they're beautifully restored, so ornate, just really amazing. And they have a full circus tent. They put on a full circus for an hour, which was an incredible show. I mean, it's a full-on circus, as you would hope at Circus World in Baraboo. So that was really a lot of fun. And then they had the circus parade in Baraboo the next day. And so a bunch of those wagons on display were now being pulled through town for the parade, which was, again, an incredible experience. I watched the whole thing from the patio of the Ringling Mansion in town. So again, you know, what better place to watch a circus parade than from the Ringling Mansion?
Couple of questions. One is the Circus Historical Society convention. Does that take place every year?
It does, but in different places. So this was Baraboo this year. Next year, it's going to be in Sarasota, which also has a great circus history. Of course, the Ringling Museum is in Sarasota. So they have it in different places. I'm not sure of all the past locations offhand, but they do move around.
And have you been to any of the locations that they have been in the past, either with a convention or just on your own because that's just the kind of thing you like?
Well, more on my own because it's the kind of thing I like. So I've been to Sarasota and I've been to the Ringling Museum. They also did one in Connecticut a few years back near the Barnum Museum, but not there specifically. And I know because I was actually just there today with the president of the Circus Historical Society and the executive director of the Barnum Museum. And then the president of the society and I went to the graveyard in Bridgeport to see P.T. Barnum's grave and Tom Thumb's grave, Charles Stratton. And he was saying that when they had the convention there a few years back, he took a whole busload of the attendees to the gravesite. So a whole bus went into the graveyard or the cemetery to see P.T. Barnum's grave and Charles Stratton's grave as well.
And had you been to Baraboo, Wisconsin before on your own?
No, I'd never been to Wisconsin before. So this was a fun trip. And yeah, really, like I said, it was great to just sort of be in this area with so much circus history and, of course, embracing all that circus history. You see elephants around town, you know, statues, depictions of elephants, of course. But you can feel that they really embrace their history, which is a lot of fun.
I just have this vision of you calling up your travel agent and them saying, "Where are you going to now, Mark?"
These are the kinds of trips I love, just going to these unusual places and uncovering fascinating history and meeting incredible people. That's a really fun trip for me.
Now, I know you were there with Dan, but do you take anyone else? For instance, do you take one or two of your daughters?
You know, I would have loved to. My younger daughter was still dealing with school a little bit, and my older daughter is in St. Louis now with an internship for the summer, so she wasn't available either. But yeah, they've enjoyed these things with me over the years, which is really special.
Well, congratulations on all the things that you did. And speaking with Dan, as you co-authored To the Hilt, A Sword Swallower's History of Sword Swallowing, and also I noticed that you had quite a few pictures up on your site.
Yeah, I posted an article on Weird Historian about my adventures in Baraboo. So lots of pictures there. You can get a little glimpse of what I was just talking about. You'll see some of the circus wagons. They really are very ornate. You'll see, I think I have a picture of Dan swallowing a giant straight razor. He doesn't just swallow swords. He swallows other very long, sharp steel objects as well. So he did a straight razor. He also swallowed a saw for the crowd as well. So that's always a good one too.
And this was a one-off, Mark, but later on in this month, you're going to have your regularly scheduled programming with the weird story for the month of July.
Yes, I'll have something nice and weird once again.
Excellent. Thank you very much, Mark.
Thank you.
Mark Hartzman, the curator of WeirdHistorian.com and also the publisher at CuriousPublications.com. His most recent book, co-authored with Dan Meyer, is called To the Hilt, A Sword Swallower's History of Sword Swallowing. You can go to our website at thestuffwhile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0881, and you'll find the link to Mark's site, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his books directly. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. And boys and girls, it's that moment you've all been waiting for. It's time now for the Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the Strange Things Adults Do. The Stuff File presents the Idiot of the Day.
A hurry to get to a LARPing tournament ended with a very real arrest in northern Arizona. On June the 11th, troopers stopped a driver clocked at 106 miles per hour in a 65 mile per hour zone in Flagstaff. The driver told troopers she was running late for a LARPing tournament in Colorado. LARP stands for Live Action Role Playing, a hobby where participants dress in costume and act out characters in fictional settings, combining improvisational theater and foam weapon combat. She was arrested for criminal speeding and booked into the county jail, said the Arizona Department of Public Safety in a Facebook post. Speeding to save a fictional realm is no excuse for drivers on Arizona highways. Now, why, oh why, would you be excessively speeding to get to a LARPing tournament so you can engage in foam weapon combat? One reason, and one reason only. You're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0881. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links and all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0881. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. And you can find me on Facebook, Spoutable, Mastodon, and Blue Sky as PA Holder. Check us out on patreon.com, where you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including kdxradio.com and over the air on stations like
World FM New Zealand,
WNRHLPFM Newport Richey, Florida,
KZZHLPFM Eureka, California,
WFNULP St. Paul, Minnesota,
CKUWFM Winnipeg,
CFMU Hamilton,
CKLU Sudbury,
Local 107.3 FM St. John,
CHSR Fredericton.
Plus, streaming on any streaming service your little heart desires. That's it. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. The Stuff File reminds you never try to drown your sorrows. Well, just learn to swim anyway.